the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I'm going to actually I'm going to stand at ease for a couple of minutes because I wanted to have a few more members here before the superintendent speaks. So I'm hoping that a few more members get here. Time friend, Representative Jensen from Pendleton, is now an official replacement for Susan Morgan. And Steve March, who has been an ex officio for, I think, a little bit more than a session, is now a regular member. So Steve has said some things about himself. Bob, would you like to say anything?
I'm not sure in this particular committee, Mr. Chairman, that maybe the best thing to do is silence avoid getting in trouble before we even get started.
Oh, we'll leave it at that. Okay, we will get started. The first item on our agenda is Superintendent Susan Castillo. We will be spending a lot of time in the next few days on the State Skills School Fund, and I believe that's sort of the introduction that you're going to give us.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, the Oregon Superintendent of Public Instruction. And it's great to see the two new members, and we look forward to working with the two of you this session. Well, before I begin, I want to make something very clear. I understand that last week you heard in a presentation that state agencies are not forthcoming with information about their duties and budget, and that agency personnel will hide or mischaracterize information. Well, let me just tell you up front that if I hear of any of my managers being anything other than honest and forthright, that manager will be gone. Your requests for information have all been taken down. We're answering those questions, and you are all welcome to come to the department anytime and see our operations whenever you want. We are working very hard to be a transparent agency, and if we fail in some way, I am personally counting on each of you to let me know how we are failing. Our public schools belong to all Oregonians, and that is how we do our work at the Department of Education. Now back to why I'm here today. Last week you had an overview of the Department of Education and the department's vital role in managing the state's public school system, and today I'm here to talk about the State School Fund, those funds approved by the Oregon Legislature and allocated to school districts through the Department of Education. On the table is a draft budget proposal of $5 billion for the 2005-07 biennium for our public schools. Now, the governor has called this level of investment inadequate. For me, different words come to mind. Inadequate, surely, but it's worse than inadequate. This draft budget proposal, if adopted, would result in serious consequences to Oregon's public schools. The Measure 1 report required from the governor by Oregon state law even suggested three roadmaps that school districts could follow on their way down to more cuts. First, they could balance their budgets by laying off every middle and high school counselor in the state, downsizing the support staff by 20%, and replacing fewer old textbooks. Second, districts could lay off about 1,000 teachers, stop all extracurricular activities, and keep their outdated computers. Finally, districts could cut school days, eliminate all teacher trainings, and, oh yeah, lay off those 1,000 teachers, too. Well, is this what Oregon has come to? In terms of real dollars adjusted for inflation, we are spending less per student than we did in the 1990-1991 school year. And I'm here this morning as the state superintendent to say that enough is enough. This backward slide in education funding has to stop, and I'm hoping, our children are hoping, that it's going to stop in this legislative session. In the past 2 years, I've visited about 100 schools, and I've seen the consequences of the state's policy of disinvestment firsthand. And I'm going to tell you about four examples, and these are in their own words to us. In the Corvallis District, large classes at Linus Pauling Middle School in Corvallis with math classes of 41, 42, and 43. We have places for kids to sit, but we are beginning to get comments from the fire department after fire inspections about maintaining adequate space for evacuation. At Corvallis High School, we will be forced to move a German teacher's classes due to violation of fire code, too many kids in the class. And that classroom has worked for 80 years, but class sizes have pushed it beyond its usability. From the Ben Lapine School District, during the first semester this year, Mountain View had several classes with over 40 students. For example, a senior class with 43 and three Algebra 2 trig sections at 40 or above. Last year, we had an AP Calculus class with over 50 students. We do have a hard time finding desks for all students in these situations or even fitting them into the classrooms themselves. When this does happen, we often just have to move chairs into the room and students sit around sides or in the back of class. From the Bethel School District in Eugene, the problem isn't that we don't have enough desks and chairs. Rather, we don't have optimum physical space in classrooms to arrange the number of desks we need. In classrooms with 30 to 35 students, classroom space is at a premium. The rooms are crowded with little room for students to move around. Arranging learning opportunities for students to work in groups is also a challenge. Some teachers sit a couple of students at tables rather than move in additional desks that take up more room. And when rooms are crowded, students have more difficulty concentrating, and teachers cannot provide the level of individualized attention that many of our students need. And from a student at Yamhill Carleton School District, last term, I was in an Algebra 2 class. It was the teacher's first time ever teaching, and on the first day of class, 40 students piled into his rather small classroom. My friend and I soon learned that if we got to class 5 minutes early, we would be guaranteed a table. Otherwise, there was no such guarantee. There were multiple days when I got to class late and found a kid who insisted upon sitting in my seat. Luckily for me, there was always somebody absent when I whose spot I could take. Now, these comments reflect just the tip of the iceberg. I know throughout your hearings you're going to be hearing a lot of stories about what's going on in today's schools. But nearly every district in the state has stories just like these, including those in all of your legislative districts. Well, how did Oregon get to this place? How did the state reach the point where individuals are considering legal action because they believe the state funding level violates the state constitution? And as some of my colleagues at the national level ask me, what is Oregon's strategy for keeping your schools out of Doonesbury this year? Well, I know that we must all do our part to get more money to the classroom. And at the Department of Education, we've eliminated management positions and functions that are not our core mission. Since the 1999-2001 biennium, our budget has been cut 16%. We're examining our rules and looking to reduce the number of reports that we ask of school districts so they can do what we all want them to do, and that is spending time teaching their kids. We're looking to stretch our dollars and our education specialists by using education service district staff to visit individual schools to convey information from us. The Department of Education is now focused on raising student achievement and ensuring accountability from our schools for the dollars that we send them. To raise student achievement, our special education staff works with districts to ensure that these kids get the kind of instruction that helps them reach their full potential. Our curriculum specialists work with districts to ensure that our kids are being taught the subjects they'll need to know at a high level of mastery and are using the best research-based curriculum available and the best teaching strategies to ensure results and make the best use of our dollars. To ensure accountability, our assessment team makes it possible for parents and the community to know how successful schools are in getting students to state standards with the dollars that we give them, setting the stage for intervention if necessary. Our finance team distributes state school funds, helps create the state and district report cards, and posts school financial data on our website so taxpayers can see how their dollars are spent. And while I'm on the topic of accountability, the department is more aggressively intervening when we find districts or ESDs misspending state funds, such as what occurred in the Union Baker ESD. Our communications team and my managers make sure every reporter in the state gets timely, accurate information, thereby ensuring the public reporting of report card ratings, AYP ratings, dropout and graduation reports, Division 22 compliance, SAT and ACT scores, highly qualified teacher reports, and many more. And in addition, I'm proposing that we make major changes to both the school report card and the federal No Child Left Behind Adequately Yearly Progress Report to come up with a single measure of school progress. And that new report card would include student performance on tests, report on majority and minority student populations, evaluate school and district financial performance, and report student behavior indicators. It would also require that students and schools make progress each year. And finally, it would give a school an overall rating that made sense to parents and community members and to all of you. In addition, the new report card would look at financial performance. That is how other schools like this one spending their money and what results are they getting. If a school is doing very well, then how can we get others to follow their example? If a school is not doing well, then how can we assist them in improvement? And if there is no improvement over time, how can we intervene and help them? But all of that is not enough. We also need to ask the federal government to step up to the plate and pay for all of the mandates that they've placed on us. The feds promised to pay for 40% of our special education costs when they enacted the law. Well, in the 30 years that it's been on the books, the average reimbursement has been closer to 18%. The federal No Child Left Behind law comes with additional funding, but it's unlikely to cover the additional expenses it will create, and we expect that funding to decrease with this year's budget. We need to take a look at current state policies and make some changes there. We need to look at the money retailers get for housing video poker machines and the governor's proposal to send the dollars generated by the new line games to police instead of education. We need to look at some of the state's tax credits, increase the minimum tax corporations pay, which has been proposed by the Oregon Business Association, and be more aggressive in collecting the taxes we already impose. The discussion about adequately funding our schools is not about budget numbers only. This discussion is not about pitting one state agency against the other either. The real discussion is about the policy choices that we make in Oregon. When will we stop looking at what is just good enough and really begin working on what we need to be the best? When did Oregon become a state where our highest aspiration is to be in the middle of the pack? When did Oregon become a state when we'd rather give a $32 million tax credit for pleasure boats instead of adding students to Oregon pre-kindergarten? The effects of cutting education now won't affect our schools, only our schools. The result of that policy choice is going to cost us more later in the human resources budget, in the corrections budget, and thwart our economic development efforts because we are all in this together. It begins with education. Because of the policy choices our state has been making, we have lost many talented people, important programs, and created obstacles to progress. The current superintendent in the Bethel School District in Eugene, some of you may have already heard, is leaving because of our current budget crisis. That is the main reason he has given. He came to Oregon from Nevada, a state that does provide adequate, stable funding for schools. And yes, superintendents have the option of leaving Oregon schools. Principals can leave. Teachers can leave. Children of wealthy parents willing to pay tuition for private school can leave too. But no matter what funding comes our way, more than 550,000 students show up for school every day expecting and deserving an excellent education in Oregon. And I'll tell you who else can't leave. The governor, legislators, business leaders, and the rest of the citizens of this state. We will have to stay and experience the consequences of our failure to make Oregon schools high-performing and welcoming place for students, teachers, superintendents, and parents. I have to tell you that I don't envy the hard job that you have this legislative session. You have a lot of difficult decisions before you. As a state, we literally have fires to put out. But I ask that you consider the long-term consequences of your decisions along with the immediate needs that you have to address. I ask that you consider the legacy we are leaving our children with our policy decisions. And I ask that you think hard as to what's best for Oregon. Our goal at the Department of Education and in our schools is progress, no matter what amount of money you give us. That is our mission. But the decisions you make will have an impact on our ability to make sure that every day, every child is a success. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Questions? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate it. All the hard work you do. We do have a difficult problem, but what I'm seeing here and just listening to your testimony, I mean, we are going to have to pit agencies against agencies. I mean, that's just where we're at. So I'm going to have to ask you, you mentioned Nevada, that they have they're able to fund their students. They do it because they use gambling. They have a niche. They're one of the eight states in the United States, or eight of the 50 states that have a surplus. They have a niche, a gambling niche. Hawaii has tourism niche. So what is Oregon's niche? I mean, if we're going to solve this problem long term, I mean, I don't know, where does the department stand on cutting timber, more timber, dedicating that to education?
I am not a forest management specialist, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, so I am not prepared to answer that kind of a question. But what I will say is I think that it is time for us, as we're looking and planning on how we create jobs, how we create a healthy economy in our state, how we promote economic development, I think that we're really missing the boat if we don't see that the number one way to achieve that is by investing in our schools and investing in education. We have plenty of examples. If we look to other parts of around the world, if we look at what Ireland did several years ago, where they made education their top priority in their country, they started putting a lot of their focus and resources there, and today their unemployment rate is very, very low. They have a very, very high literacy rate in that country. It is a vibrant place for corporations to look to. It has made a difference in that country by investing in education. We know that in China right now, the country is pouring massive amounts of resources and attention to their education system because they see it as a way of building their economic future.
Yeah. I agree with you. What I'm saying is, how are we going to pay for it? That's what I'm saying. What I'm asking you... Okay, look back at 1991. You mentioned 1991 as being kind of the watershed year. We're not spending enough money. Well, I would say to you that the decline in our ability to fund education absolutely parallels the decline in the timber industry, masked somewhat by the technology boom in the 1990s. There's eight states west of the Mississippi that have a surplus. There's Hawaii that has tourism, and Nevada that has... gambling. The rest of the states rely upon their natural resources. It's not their taxing system. Alaska has a $600 million surplus. I'd love to have a $600 million surplus. They've got oil. They don't have an income tax. They don't have a sales tax. They use their natural resources. It's an extraction industry, which people get so upset about. It's politically correct not to have this thing. I mean, I get pretty passionate about this because I agree with you. We need to spend more money. We need more money in the system. But you've got to be realistic, and folks like yourself, as superintendent of public education, a leadership position, you've got to start taking positions on this. How about use of water out of the Columbia River? I've made the statement that water is Oregon's oil. We are not using water out of the Columbia River. We ought to be taking some of that money and putting it in education. I don't know how. I mean, just because it's so politically correct, we have environmental groups that are saying we can't do that. But if we're going to solve this problem, we're going to have to go to those things. And people like yourself are going to have to take the lead on that. I mean, we do it in the legislature. The governor's got to step forward also. We can't be suing the federal government and saying, my gosh, we're going to be politically correct here in Oregon. How are we going to find this money? What is Oregon good at? Focus on our timber, focus on our water. We need $1.5 billion probably in the system to solve all the problems. $1.5 billion. What do we have in the state of Oregon that's in billions? We have billions of board feet of lumber. Let's put a tax on every board foot of lumber that we could sell, that we could cut from now on. There's $1 billion in the long term. How about water out of the Columbia River? Put some sort of assessment on using that water. Create some jobs out in my part of the country. For the whole state. Dedicate some of that to education. Alaska uses a public trust concept. That's where they get their money. They take that oil out of the ground, but a lot of that, all that money goes into the state. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, I agree with you. I think whatever you say is right. But how are we going to fund it? And Oregon's got to focus upon the things they do well. We grow trees, and we have water in the Columbia River, and we're not using them. And as a result, our children are hurting, our communities are hurting. I mean, our whole state is hurting. We'll be a mediocre state. I mean, we'll be down at the bottom. But as long as you're politically correct and we worry about the extremists in the environmental movement, we are never going to solve this problem. So I'm on my soapbox, and that's it. But that's the answer. I mean, that's where we got to go. What's good? What works?
Okay. This is real Oregon news. I'm out here with my
friends. Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson's not the only one from rural Oregon. It's very difficult to fund a excellent education system or an excellent any other kind of system in Oregon when we lead the nation in poverty and unemployment. In the figures I got the other day, in round figures, the Department of Education employs about 54,000 people. And on an average daily attendance of about 528,000 students. Is that about right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, are you talking about K through 12, all of our
yes.
school districts?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That figures out to about 9.8 students per employee. So when you speak of a school that has classes of 40, and I talked to an educator in Klamath Falls Saturday who has a math course that has 41 students in it. And she says it's difficult, and I'm sure it is. And I told her, and I'll tell you, that for the day that she's in there with 41 students, there are three other employees of the Department of Education, on average, apparently are not teaching. I wonder if we're weighting our support of education more heavily than necessary, and we're not putting enough emphasis in putting teachers in the classroom.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I'd be glad to sit down with you and go through the staffing ratios that we have, and I'm sure other representatives here would be happy to do that with you as well. I think any school district that you would talk to today, any superintendent, any principal would tell you that the staffing ratios in our districts today are very lean. There have been cuts over the last decade to district programs. Many administrative positions or management level positions have been eliminated. We have principals now wearing three different hats, as well as superintendents. There really is. I understand how you're getting to the numbers that you got to, but that does not represent what's actually happening on the ground in terms of student-teacher ratios and administrative levels of positions in our districts, and then what we have at the Oregon Department of Education. So I'd be glad to sit down and walk through that with you and answer whatever questions you have about that and listen to the advice that you have for us on what the picture looks like today. But I assure you that it does not break down to 9 students for every educator in our system and who would be available to teach our students in today's classrooms. But I'd be more than happy to have that conversation with you and hear what other questions you might have about that.
Mr. Chair, Superintendent Castillo, I don't believe I said that there was 9 students per educator. I said there were 9 students per employee.
Per employee, excuse me.
And I would very much like to discuss that with you further. And I also like, if it were possible, for you to compare for us the number of the ratio, that same ratio, among other states in the Western United States, particularly states with somewhat rural economies. If you could do that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative March.
Actually, this is for Senator Nelson. I would be happy to co-sponsor with you a measure to provide a tax on a board foot of lumber per your request dedicated to schools. If you'll let me know after the meeting what amount, I'll be happy to put it in on
that
the outside.
That would have to be an additional cut. I mean, we're not cutting enough timber right now.
Right. We'll put it on anything additional from today.
In our Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, a testimony for the Department of Forestry was there's a billion board feet of lumber that we could cut on a sustainable basis and protect the environment. And that's if you want to do that, let's just charge.
with Senator Gordon.
First of all, I want to thank the superintendent for your passion, for your truth-telling, and again for demonstrating a quality of leadership that we are blessed to have in this state. And most certainly, the children of the state of Oregon are blessed to have the quality of your leadership. What I would like to say for our record today will be a repeat of what I said on the Capitol steps last week when parents from around this state came to bring us a message about their concerns with the cut to the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and their concerns overall about cuts to education and human services. What I said that day, and I want to repeat it this morning, is that the reality is that the budgets for pre-kindergarten, for our K-12 schools, for community colleges, for higher education, and for human services are all inadequate. They do not meet the needs of our citizens and of our state. They do not meet the needs we face today, and they do not prepare us to meet the needs we know we're going to face tomorrow. All of these budgets are inadequate. They are inadequate because revenue is inadequate. And revenue is inadequate, Mr. Chair, because our revenue system is inadequate. Our revenue system is incapable of meeting the needs of our state and the growing needs of our people. We all know this, or should know this. It is one of the few areas in which there is near universal agreement. A recent study ranked Oregon's revenue system as one of the two worst state revenue systems in the nation. Only Oregon and California received D rankings in the study. And again, this is not news. We received the same rankings 2 years ago. During the 2003 session, the Oregon revenue system was broken then. We knew this. It was not news, and we did nothing to fix it. The flaws in our revenue system ensure that our budgets will be inadequate to meet the needs of our citizens. We are facing a budget crisis today because Oregon's revenue system is broken, and the legislature elected to serve the people of this state has lacked the will to do the hard work it will take to fix the system. And I will conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair, by drawing our attention again to Article 9, Section 2 and 6 of the Oregon Constitution, which states that when there are insufficient revenues to pay for government services, the legislature shall levy a tax. That mandate in our Constitution was enacted to ensure that we legislators would do our job to meet the needs of our citizens should change need to come. Change needs to come. And I believe that change needs to come now. And I say these remarks, Mr. Chair, in support of the message that the superintendent is bringing forward. And I also say these remarks in support of my good colleague, Senator Nelson. I have heard him state with passion several times in several different committee settings his proposal for how we could move this discussion forward. I think his proposal is one that has merit. We need to find our way to have a serious discussion about it. And again, I think it could be a part of overall tax reform, tax restructuring that will move this state forward. We cannot stay stuck any longer. We've got to move.
Thank you. Superintendent, along those lines of providing data,
yes,
for the committee, I know you have this data. I have spent literally 100-plus hours on your website. I know you don't have it literally for every year yet because it takes time to put the data together. But could you take the most recent complete year that you have, and I know that you have it broken down in this manner, and I know that it does not include every tiny exception to this that there would be. This is generally the general fund, not our general fund, but the general fund expenditures of school districts. And break down by school district the amount spent on central administration, the amount spent on support services, and the amount spent on instruction, both the dollar amount and the percentage of those funds spent in each of those areas for the committee to have. I think that would give the committee a pretty clear idea. Also, could you include some brief explanation of what's included within those areas, because often the support, particularly the support services, are not particularly well understood by the general public. Also, I would want to make a comment and get your comment. I don't expect you to agree with me. When I first came to the legislature in 97, and I came with Representative Jensen to my left here, Representative Jensen is actually to my left on some issues. But
that's a real confession.
I had the feeling at that time that the state as a total, the state government, the bureaucracy of the state government, viewed the state school fund as an us versus them. This is our budget, this is their budget.
Mm.
With quite a bit of, what I would say, resentment that 44, 45, 43% of the revenue went out the door. And that they also felt, to be fair, that they didn't have much say in how that revenue was being spent. I felt that that kind of started to change, and it wasn't because of me being in the legislature, it just started to change. We had some of the most partisan battles in the legislature, particularly in the House in 99 over school funding. But then when we got to 2001, the 2001 until we got the forecasts and all the issues and unfortunate circumstances that both led, not didn't lead to the recession, but exacerbated the recession, we came to broad agreement in 2001 during the session what the level of school funding should be. Some people still viewed it as inadequate, but most of it viewed it as the best we could do, to be honest, given the resources. Now, since we went into the recession in 2001, we've cut school funding in each second year of the biennium, the second year of the 2001 biennium, the second year of the 2003 biennium. We seem to be back getting to that sort of feeling of us versus them. Like this is a second tier in terms of a state priority. I know I read the governor's priorities and he lists basic education, providing a basic education to all Oregon school children as his number one priority. And he says that he conferred with state agencies in setting these priorities. And I think your department does a very good job and you do a very good job. But you're hardly a comparison to the bureaucracy that exists in other sections of state government in terms of number of people, number of analysts, and I'm not advocating you have more people or more analysts. But I just get this general feeling that we're back to this again because I just got the feeling that they were saying basically we will fund these things for these core state programs, but school districts, you are on your own, basically. You don't have to comment. That's not a I'm going to probably be called to the woodshed pretty soon. But
well, Mr. Chair, I guess how I would respond is going back to my comment about how, you know, if we don't invest here, then all the efforts that we're putting to try to decrease or address the needs of people who have issues with drug and alcohol abuse or crime, you know, earning power in terms of the kinds of jobs that they can get, all of that comes back to what we invest in education, and especially if we invest in children early. And so it really is about, yes, we have immediate needs, and I know, as I said, you have very, very immediate needs that you need to attend to this legislative session, but by not investing in schools, those needs are going to continue to grow in our state. We will not be going in the right direction. For me, this session is about not going backwards any more than we already have. I know that this is a difficult budget. I know that it would be very difficult for us to get to any, you know, we're near what the quality education model talks about. But what we really are hoping for is that we won't continue to go backwards this session. If we can hold the line on where we are, it'd be great if we could do better than holding the line. As I said, we need to be setting our sights higher for our schools in the state of Oregon. But anything, you know, if we end up with a 5-0 budget, 5-2 budget, we are going backwards more. Class sizes will grow more. More teachers will be laid off. More programs will go away. And that is what, you know, that is what I'm asking all of you to work on this session. And I will be there helping, you know, in any way I can to work with you on trying to achieve that goal. If we could hold the line, not go backwards anymore, and turn this around, this trend of constant cuts year after year and instability has just really wreaked havoc on our school programs. It is being a principal, a superintendent today in Oregon's education system is enormously challenging when you don't know what your budget looks like from year to year. It just creates a lot of difficult management decisions by our superintendents, and really they are heroes today in our education system. They are showing enormous courage in the jobs that they're doing, leading our school districts all around Oregon in these very, very difficult budget times.
Thank you. Senator Jordan.
Thank you. I do want to clarify one my comments made earlier in response to your comments, Superintendent. The constitutional mandate that I spoke of, which is to provide for the needs of our people, does not direct the legislature to simply enact a tax on top of everything else. That's not what I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm. I want to be real clear about that. The constitutional mandate requires the legislature to enact tax reform so that there is sufficient revenue. That's the distinction that I am attempting to bring forward.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, in your comments, you your opening comments, you talked about serious consequences. I guess I would appreciate, you know, more specifics. Second, you talked about that we need a single measurement for accountability. I amen that. I think we have the QEM, the school report card, the progress board. I would be interested in how much time and effort taxpayers' money is being spent to evaluate our systems. As I said when you first came last week to talk to us, I think you've demonstrated outstanding leadership in several areas that have impressed me. However, I still think I would like to see from you and ODE some leadership in looking at some of the things that I think that need to be changed. We've had the school formula since 1991. I don't see any suggestions from ODE how to make that better, how to make it up to date. Things have changed in 14 years tremendously. Mainly how we're funded. And I know that you are working with, and I'm hoping you're going to bring forth the change in ESDs, and that should have been done before. But those are kind of leadership that I'm looking for, and I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett. We'd be happy to provide more specifics on the accountability work that we're doing, and And seeing how we could break down what the spending is right now on the accountability that we currently have, which really does amount to the Oregon report card, and then under adequate yearly progress reports under No Child Left Behind. We can also just put all of that together for you. On the school funding formula, if there was a willingness, to have that conversation this session, of course we would be at the table. Providing information to everyone who wants to take a look at the formula. I guess my response to that is that every time you unless we're going to put more money into the formula, whenever you open up the formula for discussion and you want to start shifting money around within the formula, changing the weights, there are going to be winners and losers in how you do that, and unless you put more dollars into it. And so I just know from past experience in those conversations that it can get very difficult if you are a representative or a state senator representing a district, that when the formula is going to be tweaked, your district would end up losing more money because it would be going to another district. And it just becomes a very difficult conversation for legislators to have when the money starts shifting from district to district to address issues. Now, I'm not saying there aren't issues there for us to address. I agree there are. And as I said, we would be interested in helping you with that conversation and providing you information if that's a conversation this legislature wants to have this session. But I do know that it's a difficult one for the legislature once you start getting into it and you start looking at the runs of all the districts. If you tweak it the tiniest little bit and you do the runs for all of the districts on how much money they're going to get, it quickly shows where the winners and losers are, and it becomes a difficult conversation for the legislature.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you, Superintendent, for your comments. I realize that. That's why I'm looking for leadership, in that the losers and the winners are the students. And the formula is set up to reward bureaucracies and school buildings and communities and not the students. And it needs to be looked at, and that should come from you and your department first, because I'm afraid they are political and self-interest in the legislature. You didn't comment on the progress progress board report. I think during Mrs. Fleming's presentation, she used some of those as her performance or talked about those. I'm an advocate for the progress board report card, but maybe we need to look if we're spending too much. I know we had to put money in there to continue that program, but we don't need too many accountability report cards. Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Superintendent.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes. Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry. I thought I... Superintendent, I, too, appreciate your presentation. I appreciate the hard work and the hard job that you have to do in these times. And I appreciate, as others have said, the passion with which you take to that job. And certainly that's something that's absolutely critical for us to have for leadership in our state. I do have some questions, though, and maybe some editorialized comments in relationship to your presentation. For a long time, I mean forever, I've heard about the unfunded mandates, federal unfunded mandates that we have, and I suppose I'm guilty of using that topic when it fits my particular political agenda. However, I would hasten to remind us that every state, maybe with one exception, in the union has the same mandates. We're all in fundamentally the same situation. Therefore, ergo, it is not the unfunded mandates that put us into the situation that we're into today, at least in comparison with the other 49 states. So,
Absolutely. Senator, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Our current situation with our school funding has to do with the state's lack of investment in our schools, not the federal government's lack of investment in our schools. Absolutely.
And following up, then, if I may, Mr. Chair,
yes.
On that and the amount of state funding, I get, when I look at the figures, and I would admit until this assignment I haven't looked in detail at those figures this year, but have in the past, I don't see Oregon being in necessarily a completely unenviable position as far as the amount of money per student that we're putting in versus what other states are putting in. And I appreciate that's terribly complicated, has to do with the cost of living and various and sundry other things that exist in those states. But it's hard for me to use the figures that I've seen and have people bounce those off of me and say, yeah, we're really not, you know, competitive with other states in that regard. Additionally, the question has been brought up in relationship to staffing, and I think that's a very legitimate question. I have the misfortune of happening to have been around education for a good deal longer than most people in the room have been around. One of the things that over the tenure, my tenure, and I understand that's anecdotal and therefore not real good data, but from personal experience, there's been a galloping expansion in the non-teaching positions that have gone into education. I'm reminded of a comment by Dale Parnell that some of you will remember, made one time in an address that he was giving, and basically he said, remember, you know, AV don't teach. Administrators don't teach. School boards don't teach. Television doesn't teach. Mm-hmm. Teachers teach. You know, therefore, kind of supporting some of the Senator Whitsitt's comment, if you wish, on staffing. I have a real concern with that. And I know when I've looked at it in the past, it's a real jigsaw puzzle to try to figure out. And I think we in the legislature, and I don't know where this has gone at this point, but we tried a few sessions ago to come up with a standard sort of accounting principle around the state, and I'm sorry, I'm behind the power curve on that, so I don't know where that's at right now. But as we look at these staffing issues, just kind of the basic figures, like the Senator Whitsitt was looking for, the total number of people, you know, mm-hmm. versus compared to the students, comparing with other states, or maybe it's, you know, not all of the other states, but some other states, to give us, again, a little bit of, give me at least, a little bit of an example of this. Now, having said these things, I would like to make sure I'm on the record in, you know, as far as my personal positions are concerned, that we do not necessarily have to be average. We do, you know, it's okay to lead the pack. And that's the goal, of course, that I would have. And having then put this pitch in for what most people will define to be more revenue, I would come back to the point that Senator Nelson was making so eloquently. And I appreciate very much Senator Gordley's comments about, you know, our system of our taxing method and the adequacy of that. But basically, if we don't have people working. You can't lead the nation in unemployment and have, you know, a lot of tax coming in, unless you happen to be fortunate like Alaska and you just pump your money down through a pipe to the lower 48. With the record that we have accumulated over the last few years of leading the nation in our unemployment, we are destined, regardless of how we go about collecting the money, we're destined to be short of money.
Mm-hmm.
So fundamentally, yeah, we need folks in education to do what Senator Nelson was talking about. We need your office, leadership in this state, to do what Senator Nelson was talking about. Tell us how to get more, help us in this process of getting more jobs, more living wage jobs. We don't need tourism jobs. Not that we object to tourism, people coming to our state, but tourism jobs tend to be at the lower end of the scale, and as long as we're on an income tax basis, those folks are not the ones that are going to be making it possible for us to cut the size of our classrooms, to increase the number of teachers in the buildings, to increase our offerings that we have. And I could go on forever and a day on this, and I'm going to stop it. And thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I guess if I could comment on just a couple of things immediately, and then we'll get some more information for you on the other issues that you brought up today. On the issue of, I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, if we don't have jobs in the state, we don't have the revenue then, the tax base and the revenue to pay for all the things that we want to pay for in our state, including high quality schools. And so they go hand in hand. Education and our business climate and economic climate of this state are absolutely linked. If we don't have a strong education system, we can't bring industries here. People won't want to come to our state if we don't have good, strong schools. And at the same time, if we don't have a strong economy and good jobs, we don't have the revenue to support having a high-quality education system. So they are absolutely linked. I absolutely agree with you. I guess one of the suggestions I would make on where you could, I think, immediately add some more revenue to the pot that you're considering this session is I know that all of the Ways and Means Subcommittee are going through all agency budgets with a fine-tooth comb, looking for more money to try to help the budget. I would urge you to use that same level of scrutiny on the long list of tax expenditures that we currently provide in this state. I don't see how you can dive into agency budgets and really eliminate agencies' abilities to carry on the work that you want us to carry on at a very high proficient level and ignore the long list of tax breaks that we are currently giving to people in our state. Should we continue giving those? It would be great if we could just leave that list of tax expenditures alone. But in these very difficult budget times, I just don't see how you can do that when we have such difficult budget decisions this session to look at. On the issue of staffing, I know exactly one of the things that you're talking about is, as we've been laying off more teachers in our schools, growing class sizes, what a lot of districts have done is brought in and increased the number of education assistants that help in the classroom. And so the numbers of those folks have been increasing in our districts, those positions, as we've been eliminating teacher positions in order to find a way to still have some individualized attention provided to students and be able to break students up in learning groups and provide assistance to teachers who are now facing these very, very large class sizes. So districts have been looking at doing more of that in this current budget crisis. But we can get better numbers for you on the questions that you raised today. Thank you.
One quick follow-up point. Assistants don't teach. Teachers teach.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Appreciate it this morning.
Thank you.
I think that you probably got a pretty good view, and the audience got a view that this committee, to some degree, reflects the legislature as a whole. And we will probably have you back again maybe not tomorrow, but soon.
Okay.
And we'll go on now to our second presentation. We have about 1 hour for both presentations we have. So if Mr. Reeder would come forward. And we'll hopefully get through your presentation in about 20 minutes and have about 10 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the director of the Policy Research and Analysis Section at the Department of Education. Before I start, I would like to mention in response to Senator Devlin's question about presenting or providing data by district with a breakdown by how districts spend their money. A number of months ago, we did provide that sort of data in a comprehensive way to the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and we have been asked to post that same information on our website, which my staff is doing this morning. So that information will be available to you on the web. If there's anything in addition that you'd like to see that you don't find there, please contact me, because we can provide just about, as long as we have the data, it is available to you.
Mr. Reeder, and this is not an attempt to use more trees. I would like to actually get a paper copy of that also, actually, because sometimes... although the web is very available and I use it all the time, and I'd like a clear definition for the committee so that they understand what each of the categories are, particularly in terms of what's classified as instructional, what's classified as support, and what's classified as central administration. So please go ahead.
Thank you. What I would like to do this morning is really focus on three things. What I'd like to have you take away from this presentation is primarily three things. The first is an understanding of the history, the recent history, and by that I mean starting in 1990-91, which is, as you mentioned, a watershed year for school funding in Oregon with the passage of Measure 5. Understanding of the history of funding, school funding in Oregon. An understanding of the way we count students in Oregon for funding purposes, and a history of that. And then finally, I will step through in a high-level way how the funding formula in Oregon actually works, and we'll actually look at some numbers for two real school districts in Oregon. So those three things, and then I believe Steve Meyer from Legislative Revenue is here, who will get into a little more of the details of the formula and how it's changed over the past 12 or so years. I'm going to refer to the set of handouts that I provided this morning, and as I mentioned in testimony last week, if you have questions, go ahead and jump right in. So with that, I'll proceed. The first table here looks at total operating revenue to Oregon school districts since 1991 in Oregon. And the tables I've provided this morning look at only school districts in Oregon. I haven't provided any detail here for ESDs. Focusing just on school districts here. We do have the same detailed information for ESDs. It's a slightly different environment for ESDs and has been over this period, so I chose not to mix the two together, and I'll focus this morning primarily just on districts. As a glance at this, really shows two things. The first, that funding has increased over this period in unadjusted terms rather substantially. Until you get out to 2002-03, where as the economy weakened and revenue weakened dramatically, we had a rather dramatic decline in revenue to schools in 2002-03, back up in 2003-04, back down in 2004-05. The other critical piece to take away from this is the shift in the mix of funding from local governments to state governments and to the state government, and that is a direct result of Measure 5. As you can see, the local line shows a rather steady decline from 1990-91 through 95-96. That was the phase-in period of Measure 5 as tax rates phased down to the $5 limit. The next couple years after that, local revenue was fairly flat and then started growing again. In 1997-98, we had Measure 50, which imposed, not only did it cut taxes, but it imposed growth limits on assessed value. So what we've seen is rather modest growth in local property tax revenues for schools since that time. In response to those cuts in local property taxes, the state provided dramatically more money for school districts.
Yes.
If I look at your local growth curve, if that were put in constant dollar, that would actually be a decline, wouldn't it?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, we will get to that table as we move through this.
Thank you.
Mr. Reeder, one comment, and if you could respond. When you see the... I know you have a later graph that shows the inflation adjusted, but when you see the actual, and it looks like a fairly rapid increase in funding, I think it's important for people to know that now there are lows and highs to this in terms of funding per student, but we started off when we were starting in equalization probably with the, not the lowest, but the average sort of for low-funded districts, probably in the $3,400 to $3,500 per ADMW, and probably, although there were districts higher than this, some, probably about $4,500 per ADMW in higher-funded districts when we started in equalization. So as you see this rapid increase, or this significant increase in dollars, much of those dollars went to bring up those lower districts, while those that were at the higher level stayed at that level for prolonged periods of time. Would that be a correct statement? Or?
Chair Devlin, that's exactly correct. The formula that was put in place starting in 1992-93 set targets for equalizing funding per weighted student, as you mentioned, and to get there involved both bringing up the previously low-funded districts and bringing down the high-funded districts. So we brought everybody to the middle, and it wasn't, we didn't bring everybody up to the high-funded ones. We brought them all to the middle.
Yeah. Please proceed,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative.
Local versus intermediate. What's that mean on the back page?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnant, intermediate revenue would be, in this case, primarily pass-through revenue from ESDs to the school districts.
Please proceed.
The second table here is simply the numbers behind the graphs on the first table. Just briefly, the last three columns in the table shows how the shares of total operating revenue have changed over time. In 1990-91, the state was at just under 30% and districts at 66%. Today, we are virtually the flip mirror image of that. Local share is around 34% and the state share at about 56, and the federal share, as you can see, has grown some over this period, but still represents just 10% of total operating revenue in the state. The third exhibit here, the table, converts the first table to a per student basis. So, although revenue has grown rapidly, we've also seen some relatively rapid growth in our student population in Oregon. So looking at it on a per student basis sort of flattens these lines out a little bit. but not dramatically. We still see roughly the same pattern. Again, the table that follows this is simply the numbers behind these graphs so that you do have those. And then the following table, which is inflation-adjusted operating revenue per student, I believe is what Representative Jensen was asking for. And what you'll see here is a rather dramatic flattening of these lines. That total line at the top shows that starting in 1991, when Measure 5 started phasing in, we started losing ground relative to inflation up through really the full phase-in of Measure 5. And then starting in 1996-97 up through 2001-02, we did catch up. We saw some growth in funding relative to inflation. And I would point out here, and it's noted at the bottom of this graph, that the measure of inflation that I'm using here is the Portland Consumer Price Index. And the reason I use it, I'm not terribly happy about using that, because I don't believe that consumer inflation is an accurate portrayal of the cost increases that we've seen in the education world. We've seen PERS grow dramatically. We've seen health insurance grow dramatically. We've seen salaries grow rather modestly. The reality is, though, that in education, as in any other industry that is very labor-intensive, the possibilities for increased productivity due to technology, for example, are minimal. And so in the private sector, where computers are getting much more efficient and we're getting better and better at building all sorts of consumer goods at lower prices, if you look at the price of stereos, for example, they've plummeted in the last 10 to 20 years. The consumer prices have risen quite modestly relative to the cost faced by very labor-intensive industries. So I believe the consumer price index understates really the cost increases in the education world, but we really don't have a good index of education cost increases to use. Having said that, the conclusion from this graph is really that over this period, on an inflation-adjusted per-student basis, we've grown just slightly, from right around $5,000 to about $5,200, keeping in mind my previous comments that this measure of inflation probably underestimates cost increases in education. The other thing that is occurring over this time, which we will get into in just a moment, is that the nature of our students, the demographics of our students, has changed and continues to change fairly dramatically, which I believe puts more cost pressure on the system. And again, the table behind the graph provides the numbers. At this point, I'm going to shift focus a little bit and get into a more narrow view of revenue, and we'll focus solely on the state school fund. It does represent the bulk of revenue that school districts have. You'll notice that the two lines in the graph labeled state and local operating revenue. The top line is the total from the previous graph. The bottom line is that portion of it which is the goes out through the formula, both state school fund money as well as local revenue, local property taxes, and other minor sources of local revenue. So we're talking about the bulk of the money, but not all of it, when we talk about the money that goes out through the formula. And then the next graph is the one that I think, tells the story of school funding in Oregon. This shows the formula revenue on a per-weighted student basis adjusted for inflation. That's the bottom line. And the top line is the one that's not adjusted for inflation, just for contrast. And the story here, I believe, is when you take into account our changing demographics, which influence our weighted student count, and take into account inflation, we have lost on the order of $500 to $600 per student over this time period. In my mind, that is the best measure of the trend in real resources reaching students in the classroom, or not just in the classroom, but real resources reaching school districts in the state of Oregon, taking into account both inflation and our changing demographics.
Would it be a fair statement to say that when we look at the amount spent for a student that might fit into one of the categories where we would adjust the ADM, for instance, in poverty, we would be looking at the amount that we believe might be necessary to meet the needs of that student, but the basic amount, the amount here that you say is declined by about $500 to $600, is the amount that we would have to basically educate a student that did not meet any of those specialized categories. I mean, the student that's only going to receive a single weight.
Yeah, Chair Devlin, I think that's correct, but keep in mind that it's a very difficult thing to try and say how many dollars reached a particular student. It's not something that I think you can do with any confidence for most students. You know, services to students are delivered in classrooms and in school buildings, and to try to isolate resources to individual students, I think, is a fool's game.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a general concept, on average, your statement is correct.
Please. Yes, Representative Whitson.
Senator Devlin, Mr. Reeder, last Tuesday I was handed a sheet from your department that says the sources of funds to Oregon K-12, and the total district operating revenue was $8.955 billion. If you do the math, that comes out to $8,100 per student, and yet on this back of the second page, you have the total revenue per student at $7,695. Could you explain the difference there, please?
I'm not recalling exactly the number on the handout from last week that you're referring to.
It was one that should be done specifically for me. It was sources of funds to Oregon K-12, and it says the total district operating revenue for the biennium was $8.9557 billion.
And which biennium? Okay. Yeah, the difference has to do with which biennium we're talking about. Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, the handout from last week that has for 05, 06, 79, 32, and for 06, 07, 82, 11, the 76.95 on the handout from today is from 04, 05. So it's simply a difference in year.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Just a comment, you know, looking at this inflation adjusted graph, you know, I always felt that the high tech boom masked all these things. When you look at it, there was really just a total disinvestment all during that time. I mean, that's what I read out of this particular thing. I mean, I thought that when the good times, we were spending a lot more money for education, but in inflation adjusted dollars, we're not.
Senator Nelson, I think a lot of us have seen that during the 90s, if we had not had the boom in the economy, and also, although it's relatively modest, but not that modest, the increase in lottery revenue, we would have never made it in the 90s, to be honest. We would have been in the same kind of trouble we're having now or worse in the middle of the 90s.
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, you need to recall that we passed Measure 5, which cut school property taxes fairly dramatically, and at the same time really didn't replace those revenues with any new revenue source. So, and Senator Devlin is exactly correct. The robust economy of the 90s sort of allowed us to do that without noticing a really huge cut in services for both schools and other state government functions. But as we have learned in the last few years, once that robust economy slows down a bit, so do those revenues.
And, just to follow up, I guess that goes back to my original point, too, is, I mean, this if you look at the downturn in the timber industry, that started in 1991. I mean, there is a parallel there. And you know, I always tell people that when I started in 96 in Wallowa County, they had 3 mills and 3 shifts. Now they have 1 mill, 1 shift. Their student population has dropped from about 640 to less than 400. They've lost 270 students in the same period of time. I mean, and I think that's, we could probably, at least from my viewpoint, reflect that whole thing throughout our whole school system. I mean, there is a connection here, and that's I mean, I'll keep driving that phone home until you guys throw me out of the room.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Please proceed.
You'll note the table behind the inflation-adjusted graph. I'll just note one number on that table. The far right lower corner shows the cumulative percent change in per weighted student funding over that period, inflation adjusted, and that's the minus 13.4%. That's how much we've lost in real resources per student over that period going out through the state school fund. At this point, I want to start talking about how we measure students in Oregon. There has been some confusion when we talk about number of students, things measured on a per-student basis. I hope this helps clarify that a little bit. We measure students really in 3 different ways in Oregon. The first one is what we call fall membership. That is simply a count of students who enrolled in our public schools on October 1st of each year. It's a measure that's common to all states, and it's the measure that the U.S. Department of Education uses when they report per student information for all the states. So that's an extremely important measure for us to have. That's the middle line there. The second is one of the measures that starts getting us into the funding system in Oregon. It's what we call average daily membership. School districts in Oregon count the number of students enrolled each day, and this is an average over the school year. It parallels the fall membership line very closely. The reason it's below the fall membership line, there are really 2 primary reasons. The first is that for average daily membership, we count kindergartners as only a half a student, because most kindergarten students are half-day students. And remember, this is working into the funding formula, and in the formula we fund kindergarten as a half-day program through the formula. The other reason that average daily membership would be below the October 1 is that we lose students during the year, primarily to dropouts. Obviously, we have students coming and going because students move. They move out of state. We have students moving from out of state into Oregon. But in general, particularly in the high school years, we do lose students during the year due to dropouts. And that would be the second reason for the difference in these 2 lines. And then the third line is the one we use directly for funding districts in Oregon, and that is weighted average daily membership. That's after the weights have been added to the ADMR, the average daily membership line down here below. And the interesting piece that comes out of this graph, or the interesting bit of information, is that the number of weighted students has been growing faster than the number of unweighted students. That slope of that top line is higher than the slopes of those 2 lower lines. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could you enlighten me a little bit on why the weighting has grown dramatically?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, we will get into that right now.
Thank you.
The next graph will show you the primary weights that are part of the formula. The 2 top lines, the bold top line is the number of special education weights that are added. As you know, there is a limit on the number that each district can a number of added special education weights that each district can get. It's 11% of their ADM, their average daily membership. So it doesn't include all special education students. That top not-so-bold line is the total number of special education students in Oregon. And as you can see, the difference between those lines has grown over time. On average, we have a little bit over 13% of all our students are special education students, but we give extra weights to only 11% of them. Down near the bottom of the graph, you can see the poverty line has remained fairly flat. The poverty weights are based on census data primarily, and as a share of total students, they've grown, but only slightly over this period. The real dramatic growth you can see is in English as a second language students. So really the story here is that English as a second language students in particular have grown extremely rapidly, and special education students have grown slightly, but not as dramatically as the ESL students. That's where the added weights are coming from. That's right. Keep in mind that these lines show the weights, not the number of students. So for the ESL weights, since the added weight for them is a half, the number of students would be double the number of the weights. So, for example, in 94-95, there were roughly 10,000 added weights. That's 20,000 students. The next table, and I apologize for the smallness of the type here, again shows the numbers behind this graph. And it gives you that history of those weights. Unfortunately, in some of the early years, the data on those weights is not as good as we would like it to be at this point, so I don't have those numbers at this point. We are looking into some of our paper files to find those numbers in those early years.
Mr. Reeder, we have a question from Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, obviously 205, 207 are projected enrollment.
That's correct.
I thought the forecast September, forecast predicted another decline in student enrollment in the system. Where did you get that? And my other question is, if I do my numbers right here, the added weights for declining enrollments by districts, 7,000 students for this biennium, if we're paying $8,000 per student, that's $56 million we're paying for students that are not in the classroom. Is that how you read that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, none of these weights are actual students. I mean, this is a mechanism to direct money to districts where the legislature felt those districts needed more money. And one of the principles that this formula was based on was that when a district is losing enrollment, that its costs do not decline linearly or proportionally with that loss in students, that they do have some fixed costs that takes them at least a little bit of time to get rid of. And so you're correct. Those are not real students. But the rationale is that those districts, because of their declining enrollment position, has higher costs than a district that is gaining students.
Yeah, hold on. When the school formula was created in 1991, I noticed that for 2 years we had no declining enrollment, and now we've constantly had declining enrollment with a high of 9,000 in 2003-2004. That puts a big financial burden, you know, taken away from those students that are in classroom to pay for students that are not in the classroom. And I understand the system that we pay for the school building and the desk. I guess we knew did find we have enough desks now for our students. But it seems like, again, something we should have addressed, this body should have addressed, and ODE should have been addressing since 1991.
comments only, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You might explain, Mr. Reeder, that about when we used to have stop loss, and also explain basically what this is in terms of declining enrollment. My understanding is they take the decline would still take effect, but it would take effect over a longer period of time. They would be given they're basically taking either the current year or the last year, and each time you calculate this, they're going to move down to their lower enrollment over time. Is that a fair statement? Or?
Chair Devlin, you're correct. The way it works, the mechanism is that a district is funded on either its current year number of weighted students or the prior year, whichever is higher. So if they are declining in their number of weighted students, for example, if the district went from 1,000 students down to 990, they would be funded for 1,000 in the current year, even though they only have 990 students. In the following year, if they continue to lose enrollment, they would be funded again on the prior year. So in a constantly declining situation, the district would get money for the number of students they had the prior year, so it would be funded at a higher level per current year student for that period over which they are declining. And as I mentioned, the purpose of that was to compensate them for those fixed costs that simply don't go away when they lose enrollment. To answer Representative Wisner's question, obviously it does direct money, it redirects money from districts that are growing to those that are not. And the department would be happy to work with this committee to look into whether that still makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Now, at this point, I want to dig a little deeper into two groups of students that are the primary source of the added weights in the funding system, and that's special education students and students who are in English as a second language programs. The bar graph that you see looks at the number of students by special education category, and it compares two different years, 1992-93, when the formula first began, and then 03-04, which is the latest complete school year that we have these counts for. And two things really jump out here, and the first is that the bulk of special education students are not in the very high cost categories. They are in the category which is called specific learning disability, and those would be students who have a disability in reading or in some specific category of disability, and in most cases those students would be served partly in regular classrooms and partly in pull-out programs designed for their specific learning disability. But the other important thing to take from this is the dramatic growth has occurred in those categories that are very high cost, in particular autism and a category in which we call other health impairment. And that category are students who are medically fragile.
I have a question from Representative Jensen.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have a question, but I wanted to go back to the previous chart. And if you wanted to finish where you are at here, and then let me go back to the previous.
No, that's fine. We can go back now.
Okay. when I look at the chart and show ESL, I go from some 8 plus 1,000 to some 30 plus 1,000, it looks like, on the chart. You're indicating major funding formula weights, but when I look at the back page, It looks to me like you're talking about the numbers of students who fit into those categories, not what the weight would be. So I guess what I'm thinking in terms of weighting as far as ESL, is it really an increase to from 10 to 22 or 8 to 22, or is it an increase from 8 to 11?
By way of clarification.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, I believe you're misreading the table. The numbers in the table that I see are exactly the same that are in the graph.
That's my point.
I might be able to clarify in the sense when you say English as a second language and you say in 06-07 the projection is 30,531, you're actually saying that you have 60,000 students English as a second language, are you not?
That's correct.
And so you had...
Okay.
So you had... You had about 12,000 students in that category in 92-93, and now you have about 60,000 students in that category.
That's correct.
So then when you talk about special ed weight, the number of students there is 124,000, 125,000?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, special ed students are weighted at one, at
I know, I
an extra one.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it would be 120,000.
No, it would not.
No, I'm sorry. It would be 62,000.
I beg your pardon.
Correct.
You can't have it
correct.
Both ways.
Yeah. It would be 62,000.
In both the graph and the table, these are weights.
Yeah.
And because special ed students are weighted at a full additional 1.0,
okay.
The number of weights is exactly the same as the number of okay. students.
So it's not based then on average daily ADM. Kind of left me to conclude that this was an N for students.
No, I think if you look in the left-hand column, it defines them as the weights, not the students.
Go ahead.
Clarification here on the special education weights at 62,648 for 06-07. Obviously, there would be 62,648 special ed students, but is that the actual number or is that the capped number? In terms of, you said it was capped at 11%.
Chair Devlin, that the number when I talk about weights, it is the capped number. Keeping in mind that there is a committee that does allocate some additional weights,
right.
And those are included. So it's the 11% cap plus those. Those added above the cap, which is a couple of thousand more.
Representative March.
To follow up on that and your next chart with the high-cost categories, low-cost categories, the high- and low-cost categories are weighted the same. They're weighted as one additional weight, as I understand it, with the caps and the little special parts.
Chair Devlin, Representative March, that's correct. I should mention, though, that we have now... And it doesn't affect the weighting system, but we do now have a what we call a high-cost disability fund that provides reimbursement for students, very high-cost students, to provide additional dollars for those students, even though they still only get an added weight of one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
And keep in mind that in the state report card document, which I believe you all have, the weights are explained on page 42, so if you need an additional reference. The following table shows some expenditure information for special education programs and compares that growth over time. As you can see, over the period of 1991 through 2002-03, special education expenditures of school districts increased from $110 million to $460 million. It's over 300% increase, or about 12.6% a year on average. Contrast that to all other operating expenditures, in other words, expenditures for non-special education programs over that same period grew at 65% or a little over 4% a year. So dramatic growth in expenditures for special education programs, well above spending on what we would term as regular programs. The following table provides similar information for English as a second language program. We don't have as long of a history of the spending information for those programs. Those programs have been in place over that same period, but we did not gather the detail, the spending detail for those programs back in the early years prior to the database initiative project. So I can't break them out in those early years. But even the last 4 years shows rather dramatic growth in spending on ESL programs. Again, when you spend additional dollars on those special programs, that diminishes the dollars available for what we would consider regular programs, which is part of the story here is, you know, even though funding on a per student basis has risen over time and on an inflation-adjusted basis has been fairly flat, more and more of those dollars have been redirected to special programs at the expense of regular instruction programs.
One clarification on the special, going back to the special ed, since this is an all operating expenditures number, do we know in terms of that growth from 110 to 460 between 1990 and 2002, how much of that growth can be attributed to, well, the revenue attributed to increased federal expenditures, or and how much of it's attributable to general fund and local expenditures?
Chair Devlin, I didn't include that information. I believe we do have that information.
Okay.
And I am happy to provide that.
And we do not receive any additional federal assistance based on English as a second language, do we? Or
no. Chair Devlin, I don't know the answer to that. I can also get that information for you.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you point us to the information or documents that will tell us what results we're getting for the expenditures in this category?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, specifically in special education category?
In English as a second language.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, yes, I do have information on standardized test scores for those students. I'm happy to provide that.
For all districts?
Yes, all
Thank
districts
you.
that have ESL students.
And I would also say the same information for the special ed students would also be valuable. Again, outcomes, results for the expenditures.
Chair Devlin, I do have, I was handed some information. The federal government does provide some funding for English language acquisition is what they term it, Title III grant money. In the 03-05 biennium, that amounted to $9.5 million in Oregon, and the proposal for 05-07 would be $10.9 million.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How is that distributed? Where does that show up?
Yes. Representative Jensen has asked how that's distributed, and we may need to call Dr. Burkett.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, Title III funds do not go to all districts. They go to districts that have a certain percentage of eligible students. The funding is distributed on the basis of students that are deemed to be eligible, that is, students who have been identified as an English as Second Language program. In addition, there are a smaller amount of funding also under Title III and an amount under Title I-C for migrant students. And these are students who have a slightly different eligibility category, and the funds are distributed on a headcount of the students who meet those criteria. So it's based on the number of eligible kids in eligible districts.
But a district must reach, as far as the Title III ESL, they must reach some level before they get anything.
That's correct. They have to reach a minimum number of eligible students. There are students in the state who are both migrant and receiving English as Second Language services in districts that do not receive federal funding for those students. We can give you a breakdown, Representative Jensen, of the districts that receive those funds, if that would be helpful to you.
Please proceed.
Okay. With that background on the weighting system, what I would like to do now is step through on an aggregate basis how funding finds its way through the state funding formula. And so the table labeled formula allocation of formula revenue to school districts, I'd like to just step you through that so give you an understanding of how we get from the legislative appropriation for the state school fund to dollars arriving at the doors of the school districts. So we start, and I'm basing this on the governor's proposed budget as a place to start. $5 billion proposal for the two-year budget period. Add to that local revenue, both school districts and ESDs, of a total of $2.5 billion, brings us to a total of $7.5 billion. Off the top of that amount comes dollars that go out to special state programs such as long-term care and treatment facilities, some money to deaf and blind schools, that totals $18.5 million, leaving $7.5 billion to be distributed by formula to both districts and ESDs. The district share of that under current law is 95%, and that number would then be $7.136 billion to go out through the formula in the 2 years. Typically, we divide that, although the legislature has chosen to specifically allocate it in some years, but typically we would divide that 49% in the first year of the biennium and 51% in the second year. So that's how that division was made to the 2 years here. And then below that you can see that the remaining 5% or $376 million for the biennium would go to ESDs. Now below the line I get into a little more detail on the district side of things, again ignoring ESDs for now. And I choose just a single year here, the 05-06 school year. So that first number at the top, 3496.7, that's the same number that's up above for the first, that's shown under the first year of the biennium. Off the top of that, we take $12 million for the high-cost disability grants that are given out for very high-cost special education students. We also take off the top $145 million for transportation grants. That's reimbursement of districts for their either 70, 80, or 90% of their transportation expenditures. And we also take off the top $8.8 million for facility grants. Those go to districts who have built new buildings or renovated buildings, and those grants are can be used to pay for things to furnish those either new or renovated structures. That leaves us with $3,330.9 million to send out through the formula under what we call general purpose grants, and that's the per ADMW amount that goes out through the formula. We expect in the 05-06 school year to have 659,407 weighted students in the state, which would result in an average general purpose grant of $5,051. Now, when we start allocating money to districts, they get that grant, but then they also would get back the money through the high-cost disability, the transportation, and the facility grants that we took out up above. Those would go out to districts, not on a per-student basis, but in the case of the high-cost disability and transportation grants, on a reimbursement basis for their expenditures, and on a facility grant based on the cost of the either new or renovated buildings that they have brought into service for this school year. So high-cost disability grants, on average, $18 per weighted student, and that's not per special education student, but per all students, per all weighted students. Transportation grant, an average of $220 per weighted student, and a facility grant, an average of $13, bringing the total amount per weighted student going out through the formula to $5,303. That's a quick, high-level overview of how the money goes out through the formula. And the last thing I would like to do on the next two pages is look at two examples for specific school districts in Oregon. The first one I picked at random for no particular reason. It displays, this is the sheet that we provide on our website at a number of times during the year that give districts the estimates of how much money they can expect to get through the formula. As you can see, starting at the top left, we start out by giving them all the components of their ADMW, allows them to add them up. In this case, starting out with 79.3 ADM, or what we call ADMR, R is for resident, adding all the weights and brings this particular district up to 173.3 weighted students. Then it compares that number to the number they had in the prior year, because they are funded on the higher of the two numbers. In this case, this district gained almost two students from last year to this year, so they would be funded on the current year. And then something that we haven't talked about yet, there is an teacher experience adjustment in the formula. To the degree that the average teacher experience for a district is different from the statewide average, they get either more or less money.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real fast, Mr. Reeder, I appreciate. Could you give me a total amount of money that's expended for the teacher experience? Is that available easily? Not now, but
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisner. Again, like other aspects of the formula, it moves money from some districts to another, but I can get you an estimate of how much money it moves around, yes.
We will get a more clear explanation on that particular issue tomorrow when Mr. Meyer goes through the formula in some detail. So,
thank you.
Okay. Over on the right-hand side of this table shows sources of local revenue. And then below that, the calculation of this district's transportation grant.
Clarification, Mr. And we do need to close up here pretty soon, but on the non-reimbursable, which of those expenditures were non-reimbursable, or are they something they're not listed?
Chair Devlin, the way the law currently reads is that trips to and from school, as well as trips that have an educational basis to them, are reimbursable. So field trips typically would be reimbursable, and then anything to and from school for the regular school day. Athletic trips are not reimbursable, and anything that does not have anything else that doesn't have a non-educational basis to it would not be reimbursable. Then the bottom of the page shows the actual calculations, the formula calculations that we go through to arrive at the amount of money that each district will get. I won't go through that equation in any detail. But on the right-hand side, you'll see under the heading 0203 Total Formula Revenue, it shows the total of the general purpose grant and the transportation grant equaling $811,000. Back to the left-hand side of the page, it takes that $811,244, subtracts out the district's local revenue to arrive at how much the state will pay the district out of state funds, the $609,691. And then the bottom is just some cash flow information, how much that we've paid to date, how much their small high school grant is, their facility grant, and so forth.
And similar information for the next school district.
The next school district I chose because it is one of only two or three districts in the state where their local revenue is higher than the total that they would get through the formula, so they don't get any state money for their as a formula, as a school fund grant, their state amount is zero. They would still qualify for small high school grants. But they do not qualify for general formula funding because their local revenues are so high.
It might be noted that their local revenue is timber revenue.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, in general we have two types of districts that have very high local revenue. Those would be districts that have significant timber revenue, and the other category are districts over on the coast where they have very high property values because of second homes and commercial property relative to the number of students they have.
Mr. Reeder, could you point out one thing on this? The remote small school correction, although both of these school districts have that correction, before anyone looks at that and says this is causing a major impact in the relative, I don't want to use a pun, but there are relatively small number of districts and small number of ADMW that are impacted by the small school correction. Is that correct? Or?
Chair Devlin, that is correct. That mechanism is designed to direct more money to small districts that have small schools. We have a lot of small districts that don't have small schools, but some of them do, and you have to meet both qualifications. You have to be both a small district and have small schools, but it is a relatively small amount of money.
I do note that for a particular reason I like to tell the committee is I do get calls occasionally from constituents, and they'll read that some small school district in Eastern Oregon receives like $9,000 per actual student or $10,000 per actual student. And trying to explain to them that correction, I think you usually can explain to them that correction when you get a chance to, but if that correction wasn't there, in terms of how few number of students it actually impacts, it might raise my amount per student in my districts by a dollar per student. I mean, people just see those numbers. The Oregonian occasionally does articles that shows this disparity, and I think it's just a reflection of how difficult it is to meet the needs of students when you have a very small school district. So,
Chair Devlin, that is the end of my prepared remarks. Are there any final questions?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. With an eye toward the time that we're going to be spending on performance measures, and looking at the growth in special education students, reading through the performance measures, it's difficult to fully grasp what the outcomes are, what outcomes are expected for special education students in any of the categories, but particularly for students with specific learning disabilities and speech-language impaired students. And I would appreciate some assistance from the department in honing in on the information that teases out for us what those outcomes are. What are the expectations?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, my colleagues who know much more about that sort of thing than I do will be happy to provide you with any needed information.
There's a lot of information, and much of it is very good. It's just difficult. I'm finding it difficult to hone in on that specific piece.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Reeder.
Thank you.
We will come back tomorrow morning for Mr. Meyer's presentation. And with that, if there's nothing else from the committee, we are adjourned till tomorrow morning.